Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirements will come to order. It's Tuesday, March 19th, 2013. And the first order of business is the approval of the minutes for March 5th and March 12th. Okay, Senator Johnson moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The first bill then on the agenda is Senate File 529, House File 650, TRA, Ms. Hacking.
Thank you, Madam Hi. Chair. Hi, members of the commission. I believe you have in
Just say your name again for the tape.
Laurie Hacking, Teachers Retirement Association. I believe you have in your packets a one-page handout. It has some color on it. I'm going to be referring to that. Titled House File 650, Senate File 529, TRA Alternative Actuarial Reduction Factor Bill. Before I get into the bill, I wanted to give you a little bit of background on this issue. As a result of our experience study a few years ago, our experience study, which is done every 4 years, where they look at all of our assumptions and actuarial methodologies to ensure that they are as accurate as they can be. At our last experience study, the actuaries determined that we needed to change the actuarial methodology that is used to determine the early retirement reduction factors. And the reason for this change was because the post fund, some of you may recall, was dissolved in 2009. And one of the features of this actuarial methodology entailed using the post fund interest rate, which was no longer appropriate given that the post fund was dissolved in 2009. So there was a significant methodology change, and the result of this change is that there will be very significant cuts in benefits to members who are retiring early. And this cut will occur fairly precipitously. We have actually about 11,000 to 12,000 teachers who are in a category of being near to retirement, meaning they're in their 50s or 60s, anticipating retiring in the next couple of years, or 5 to 10 years, I'm sorry. And they will see a fairly significant decline in their anticipated benefit level. And these are people who have been running best benefit estimates periodically, checking and making their plans as to when they would retire. To understand the magnitude of the cut, I'd like to refer you to this table that's got white and pink columns. And the white columns show what the factors are, have been up until, are currently. And the pink is what the new factors are under this new actuarial methodology. So, for example, to help you read this table, if someone who's age 55, that's the first row in the table, under the old factors would receive a benefit equal to 58.556% of the benefit available at normal retirement age. Under the new factors, that would drop dramatically to 46.299%, which is a 21% reduction. And then you can see as they're at the higher ages, there's still a significant cut, but it starts to decline the older or the higher the retirement age that the person goes out with. Now, this is a side issue that I'll just explain. We have another amendment that the three systems are recommending. I think perhaps you'll be taking that up later, hopefully, that in TRA's case, we are phasing in these reductions over the next 5 years so that people have enough adequate warning that this is coming, and we're delaying the effective date by 1 year. The other systems, MSRS and PARA, are doing some similar phase-ins. They're doing actually a 3-year phase-in with a delayed effective date. We needed a five-year phase-in because our cuts are pretty are more significant than what PARA and MSRS see with their factors. So that's just the background. So to the bill, if you could turn the page, I'll describe what the bill is proposing. Our board, the TRA board, spent a number of months looking at these new factors and really didn't like the results, the harsh and negative impact of them. So what we are proposing in this legislation is sort of a middle ground. It will allow some of the cuts, early retirement cuts, to flow through, but it restructures the factors so that there is an encouragement for delayed retirement. And the restructuring, if you could kind of look at the table on this page so I could explain it, I already described the old factors and the new factors. In the light green column are the proposed factors. And these would be the factors for individuals who are not long service, age 62 and 30 years. But in the dark green would be the factors for members who do attain age 62 with 30 years of service. So what you can see is these factors are set up to encourage the member to stay in the workforce to age 62, preferably, and even beyond. And if they do, then their benefit amount is better than it would otherwise be. So, again, just to stress, this is a redesign of the factors so as to encourage later retirement. Another side benefit to this is that the factors would be fixed in law and would not be changing around by actuarial methods and that sort of thing. So that's another advantage for our members. The bill is designed to be cost neutral, meaning the board tried to stay within the cost parameters of the current plan and not add any additional costs. If we did go to the pink column, there would be a fairly significant benefit cut, as I described before, equal to about $380 million, and it would reduce our costs by 0.86% of pay. So by going to the green, we would be foregoing those savings, but again, we would not be adding any costs above and beyond what is already currently assumed in our valuations. So in a nutshell, that's what we're trying to do is restructure these factors, actually specify them more directly in law, and do so in a way that encourages later retirement. And I don't want to neglect to mention that there are a couple of folks in the audience who would like to indicate their support for this bill at the appropriate time. Louise Sundin with the Committee of 13 and Jan Allswagger with Education Minnesota.
Comments from the pension staff. Mr. Martin.
Members, I think Ms. Hacking has indicated to you the changes that are in the bill. I've raised some concerns about the proposal, looking at the question from a historical standpoint and as an part of the institutional memory of the commission. These changes in the statute, if you are in the proposed piece of legislation, if you turn to page 3 of the bill, this would be the last page, second to the last page. It's double-sided, it's the last piece of paper. These only really apply to a portion of the TRA benefit structure. It applies to individuals who are hired after 1989. If you look on page 3, line 18, you can see that the new language is applicable to the post-89 folks. This is part of the benefit tier that's known as the level benefit tier. It's the alternative or the other benefit tier other than the rule of 90. And when this plan, when this tier was created in 1989, It was to apply to all new hires after 89 exclusively. The rule of 90 was not extended to the post 89 individuals, and the early retirement reduction factors that were retained by TRA and all of the other plans that added on the rule of 90 at that time was the actuarial equivalent early retirement reduction. And this picked up on a dispute that was in the Pension Commission back in 1978 over formulas, what factor, what rate should be applied to early retirement. The commission in 78 actually went to a conference committee, fairly significant dispute among commission members over which rate. And the resolution ultimately was to, since the actuarial reduction, the reduction that's needed to have the same value be given to someone who retires early that they would have if they waited and retired at the regular age, is not a straight line factor. It's a curve rather than a straight line. If you were to graph it, a single rate doesn't adequately catch what's going on. And some individuals would get a break, would get more value than other early retirees. And so ultimately the resolution in the conference committee in 78 was to go to the actuarial equivalent, if that's the real goal here, and it was in 78, and that was carried forward in 89, is to give folks the same value that they would have had if they waited, and to adjust it to account for the fact that they're going early, then having an actuarial equivalent reduction factor is the way to do it. This is the first time that the commission would be upsetting that, would be going to something other than the actuarial equivalent, and that's of some concern, in part because of the long history of the actuarial equivalent reduction, and the fact that it really does put the finger on the scale, as it were. Some individuals are going to do better under would have less of a reduction and than they would have had if they got an actuarial equivalent reduction. Others will get more, and that does run counter to the general commission principle of having uniformity. You have some uniformity if you give everyone the value that they've actually earned, and not more and not less. And so, one of the problems I have with this is that it does put the finger on the scale, as it were. It does treat some individuals better and some individuals worse. These early retirement reductions are sometimes referred to by the membership as penalties, but they're not actual penalties if they're actuarially equivalent. They're the an adjustment so that the same value and only the same value is given to a retiree. What is going to happen potentially with the proposal we have before you is some folks will actually be penalized and some folks will be given a bit of a deal, and that's the first problem. As Ms. Hacking indicated, the current law, if implemented, would actually save TRA in approaching 1% of pay. And although there wasn't real current actuarial work presented in the information I saw on this, this has a very slight net cost to TRA. So we're giving up an opportunity for a fairly significant savings that the current law provides for. And that really makes us what I would term a benefit increase and not just a mere modification or a mere accommodation of a technical problem. Then the lack of uniformity, this is consistent in all of the level benefit tiers and all of the plans that have the rule of 90. TRA would be departing from that later on. When you look at the St. Paul teacher proposal and the Duluth teacher proposal, it's my understanding that they're also changing their early retirement reduction factors from an actuarial equivalent to something else. So there will be presumably more of that, and we'll be faced with the issue of trying to figure out what is a fair reduction factor again. So, members, that those are the comments that I would like to make.
Ms. Hacking,
yes,
response.
First, I guess I'd like to point out that with respect to Mr. Martin's point that we're departing from actuarial equivalent, we already have and have for many years. The rule of 90 construct, and actually you can read in the bill itself, lines 2, 18, 19, provide for early retirement reduction factors that are not equivalent at all. In addition, within this formula itself, lines 310 through 315, we have a significant augmentation that has been in current law, as Mr. Martin described, way back to the 70s. So we don't really have actuarial equivalent currently with our factors, so it's not a new concept to deviate. And the reason we're proposing a deviation is to, in fact, encourage later retirement, which we think is a good thing for the system and a good thing financially for the system. So that really is our motivation. Mr. Martin refers to it as sort of tipping the scales. It is a deliberate sort of tipping for the objective of encouraging later retirements. So that's really, I think, the main point I'd like to make.
And Ms. Hacking, you would then consider the dark green column, the encouraging later retirements, because those years have better figures, higher figures, or is that what you'd say?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, yes. If the person does wait till they're 62, and if they're long service with 30 years of service, those factors do become more favorable. And in a sense, it's an encouragement to stay in the workforce for that reason.
But the new factors, the encouragement is even stronger to stay in the workforce.
Madam Chair, yes, are you talking about the dark green?
I'm talking about the pink. I mean, in fact, you don't really even, the pink would lead you to stay in the workforce till you're 66, the new factors, which may not be good for teachers to stay in the workforce that long.
Well, that, Madam Chair, I think it's a judgment call as to whether teachers stay in the workforce, whether that's positive or not. Financially, we believe that encouraging later retirement is good. And you're correct, the pink does encourage later retirement, but the dark green is a stronger encouragement to remain in the workforce to age 62 with 30 years of service. So any of these columns, there's an encouragement to retire later because you sustain less of a penalty.
Right.
But if you notice under the green, there is a marked change in benefits at age 62 with 30 years of service. So someone who's thinking about age 60 or 61 would look at a benefit estimate and see a certain amount. If they look and waited till they were age 62, that amount would be significantly larger.
Any questions from members of the commission? Why don't we take Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I get your rationale there, the idea that you're kind of looking at 62 as a point, but just actuarially, they would go from 0.753 to 0.855, so they would go up 10% in their pension by hanging on the 1 year from age 61 to 62. I've got to believe that waiting that 1 year wouldn't counterbalance that increase in the amount that they'd receive in the pension. That's got to harm the fund to some degree. Is that not right?
Ms. Hacking.
And Chair Senator Thompson, There are costs in this that the actuary did consider in making their cost estimate. So that is built into this, and changing retirement patterns is a hard thing for them to predict. But as I said before, we tried to design this in a way that would spend no more money than we have currently projected in our valuations. But yes, there is, by giving people higher benefits, there is a cost down the road. That's true.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It just seems to me that if we're looking to save costs to have that dramatic a difference for 1 year, I mean, it would be, I mean, unless you came into some health problem or something like that, to retire at age 61 would be insane because of the jump to 62, right?
Are you comparing the pink column to the dark green column?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I'm looking at
on the back. No,
I'm
back
looking
page.
I'm looking at the green. If you look at the
dark green.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry. You're right, Madam Chair. The pink, comparing it to the dark green, or for that matter, the light green or the dark. The point is, from 61 to 62, the jump is dramatic.
Madam Chair, if I could clarify, Senator Thompson, right? You're looking at the light green at age 61 compared to the dark green at age 62. That's the correct comparison.
Right.
Okay. It is. Why don't we take some testimony then? Some people wanted to testify. I only have King Banyan. Is Mr. Banyan here? Okay, why don't you go ahead, and then I heard that there were a couple others who wanted to testify. But Mr. Banyan called in and got on the list.
King Banyan.
Hint, hint. Representative Banyan, welcome to the Pension Commission.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioners. Good to see everyone again. Thank you. I'm going to be talking about a few bills tonight off and on, and Commissioners, I have a kind of a common theme to this discussion. That common theme is history is good to know, and history is important in understanding what we're talking about this evening. With regard to this particular bill before you now, I think it behooves our commissioners to read the staff report carefully. There are a couple places where it makes some references, and you heard Ms. Hacking make a couple statements of the fact that this does cost money. This is a loss of savings that happens, loss of savings that you have passed in the past, in past legislation, to help shore up this fund. This fund is a fund that has some difficulties. If you look at page 4 of your staff report, of the staff memo that I believe Mr. Martin distributed to you, you can see that your funding ratio in this plan has fallen from 77.27% in fiscal year 2011 to 72.99% in fiscal year 2012. Yet the paragraph below that concludes, Mr. Martin writes, this proposed legislation is the only proposed legislation sponsored by TRA this session, but the proposed legislation actually increases TRA's financial difficulties. Nothing that I have heard from Ms. Hacking seems to contradict that particular statement. I think the one other thing I would point out in listening to Mr. Martin as well is to understand what it means by actuarial equivalent funding. What does that really mean, members and commissioners? And I think what that means, and what's important for you to remember, is actuarial equivalent means that the decision of a teacher to retire does not influence the cost to the employer, taxpayers, over the course of the lifetime that person is likely to be retired. Sometimes they'll do better, sometimes they'll do worse. It depends on a number of things. Most importantly, their mortality. But for the most part, the idea was, when you passed the legislation initially, the thought was your decision of when to retire should not influence your costs. It should be the same whether you're 55 or 65 or any point in between. That seems like a good principle to hold. I would encourage you to continue to hold to that as much as you have, and indeed to not place fingers on the scales. Thank you. I'm happy to stand for questions.
Are there any questions? Hey, thank you very much. Did you have a question?
No, thank you.
Ms. Sundin, or whoever wants to come up next, please come. Ms. Thalschweiger. Both of you.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Jan Allswager, testifying on behalf of Education Minnesota. We're encouraging you to support this bill. Many of our members plan for retirement years in advance, and making significant reductions to their anticipated benefits will severely hurt many of our members. So we support it for the following reasons. The phase-in of the lower early retirement benefit over a five-year time frame we think will be helpful, and it also provides a slightly less severe reduction penalty, giving our members a little more financial cushion upon their retirement. So I will just leave it at that and turn over to Ms.
All right, Ms. Sundin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Louise Sundin, and I am here representing the Committee of 13 with over 8,000 active and retired members in TRA. I'm a retired 30-year ninth grade English teacher, and look forward to this continuing discussion. But before I start with this specific bill, I want to also, our members always want to take the opportunity for those of you who were here over the last decade or so, and for those of you who are new, to thank you, and thank you for what I call the trifecta that saved Minneapolis teachers' pension security. And that started in 2006 with the merger of MTRFA with TRA, including the additional funds that we brought with us at that time and continue to. And for the record, I retired under the basic provisions of MTRFA the Monday after the Sunday that some of you may remember, in which that bill passed at, I think, 6:59 a.m., and the legislature approved that merger. So Millard and Flora Sundin, who were both Minneapolis teachers, created another Minneapolis teacher, but no fool. So the second is the 2008 merger of the post fund and the active fund, and the third of the trifecta was the 2010 pension fixed bill. And so we are appreciative. Now you have the opportunity to do an age 66 fixed bill. So we're hoping that you do. The majority of our active teachers do not qualify at this point for anything other than age 66 and out. And in the past, when newly hired teachers would ask when they'd qualify for a pension, we'd sort of cavalierly say, well, you're going to have to work for the rest of your natural lives. It isn't as funny anymore because now that has come true. So they will begin teaching if they begin teaching at age 26, and it'll take a minimum of 40 years under the current atmosphere of the once proud and now pilloried profession of teaching is only relieved by a reasonable retirement that comes now at a much discounted rate, as you saw from the charts. The sound sometimes I hear in my head now is a kindergarten teacher falling off one of those tiny little kindergarten stools who's saying, I've fallen and I can't get up. And I can't get that out of my head. You know, there was a time when a pension, when teaching was just considered pin money or a second income for women, that of course is no longer true. It's still true that over 75 to 80% of active teachers are female, and that number is increasing under the current economy, not decreasing. And around half of those are single women, and we have to survive on our own. They are now caught up in this catch-22. If a teacher leaves prior to age 66, she'll suffer as much as a 20% decrease in that pension that she has to live on, and that is too much. The only choice in the world, in this world, she has that favors youth over wisdom and experience. So the push and the pull comes in keeping her career-honed skills for the benefit of the kids and the sometimes not-so-subtle effort to push her out. So it's time for a change, keeping in mind the need to balance experience and age and gender and retirement security. So the TRA trustees have taken on this challenge. We support the TRA proposal and the bills to modestly mitigate the severe penalties that face our future retirees by following the legal mandate for to be actuarially sound, encouraging and incenting teachers to stay on, but easing slightly the penalties to teachers when they have to leave. So for these reasons that we support the two bills and the phase-in, and I thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, members, thank you very much, Ms. Sundin. I appreciate that.
We want to ask anybody else.
Is there anyone else that wants to testify? I don't want to miss anyone who might have showed up on a bill we had last week. So I guess I just want to share, I want us to have a little discussion about this, if we can, members. And I just want to share my own, I'm kind of torn on this, because if we let the new factors go into play. Oh, wait a minute, before we have a discussion, Mr. Martin, why don't you explain the amendments? Like probably the 2A amendment is more relevant.
Members, I've provided in your packets two potential amendments which have to do with whether the delay makes sense. 1A simply requires TRA to do the change in 2013 rather than waiting until 2015 to start it and then phasing it in over 5 years. A similar provision, 2A, is the same notion but would apply to all of the various general employee pension plans that have the rule of 90, have the level benefit tier, and have the actuarial equivalent normal our retirement or early our retirement our reduction process, and this provides that they all would be compelled to make these factor changes in 2013.
So that would implement then the pink column. Right.
Yes, Madam Chair. The pink column is what's called for under current law, and this would put it into effect right away in 2013. In some cases, TRA, for instance, the mortality table change occurred in 2010. So these the need for having an actuarial equivalent, our reduction factor, in some cases, has been hanging around for some time.
And none of the pension funds have implemented the new mortality tables?
Madam Chair, I believe that there's been some work to implement them for optional annuity factors based on having the Pension Commission actuary involved in a review of that. I'm not aware that anyone has done anything on the early retirement factors. You might want to ask them.
Since this Amendment 2A does impact all the pension funds, then we should probably hear from you. The others as well. Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the Director of the State Retirement System. Let me just give a little bit of background on this. If you remember last session, Representative Lanning asked us to address this issue by January 1. Our boards approved the tables in the fall. MSRS board approved the tables this fall. They have been submitted to the Pension Commission actuary for approval, and they have not been approved. That would be the early retirement factors and the joint and survivor factors. And we're talking a book of survivor factors about and early retirement about three times this thick. So we haven't even gotten them approved yet. Once they're approved, we have to program them. And that is no easy feat, as they are very thick tables. So implementing them by July 1 of 2013 is impossible. We are actually requesting, in an amendment that Ms. Hacking talked about, to let us phase in these changes. For MSRS, we're not asking for any restructuring. We plan on implementing the tables as they are. We would save 0.4 to 0.5% on our contribution rate, so it would lower our required contribution. It would lower our liabilities. But what we're requesting is for our boards the ability to phase them in over a period of time. We're looking at MSRS for 3 years, and we're looking for that phase in for a reason.
Thank you.
So we are looking at potential savings, and if we don't notify members, our legal risk goes up, so our litigation risk increases. If we don't notify our members and give them time to retire, we're going to see a rush to retirement, which would drive up the number of early retirements and have the exact opposite impact of what I think we're trying to accomplish. So we are willing to implement the tables. They are substantial. We are asking for our boards to have that authority. And logistically, we are at a point where we need time just to get them implemented, pending approval by the Pension Commission actuary. So we've done what you've asked. We did get some of these mortality changes in 2010, but we were waiting to see what the investment assumption that you passed last year was, because they had an impact as well. And this is, you don't want to change tables every year because it affects members' benefits. So from MSRS's standpoint, all we're requesting is an ability to slowly phase in these tables over a three-year period, which we think is in the best interest of our members and, quite frankly, in the best interest of our fund.
Okay. Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair, Mary Vanek, para executive director. I repeat everything that Mr. Bergstrom said. The other thing I wanted to point out is that this is the first time the tables have been changed since the post fund dissolved, as Ms. Hacking mentioned earlier. The other times that we changed tables, it usually was only a mortality assumption change that impacted them, and usually that was a favorable change. So we could implement immediately because it was a favorable result to the members. Mm-hmm. This is the first time that I recall that we have an unfavorable result for our members, and it's only fair that we give them sufficient notice.
So, Mr. Bergstrom, how much savings did you say you're going to gain even with the phase-in?
Madam Chair, our savings would be somewhere, it would lower our required contributions by 0.4 to 0.5, somewhere in there.
And Ms. Vanek, how about for you?
Madam Chair, we don't know exactly, but our savings would probably be about half of what MSRS is expecting to save.
And Ms. Hacking, is this calculated into your bigger proposal?
Yes.
So you get some savings, but then you also do a bigger phase-in?
Yes.
Phase-in so much, but you alter the factors.
Madam Chair.
Trying to understand. You should just talk and I should shut up.
That's okay. Madam Chair, the proposed bill also has a phase-in feature to it, a five-year phase-in. That's correct.
It has a five-year and you have a three-year.
Right. The reason we have a five, right, and they have three is the impacts as a result of our factors were much more severe. And we carefully calculated what it would take to phase this in so that people, as Mr. Bergstrom described, would not rush for the door to try to get in out the door before the new factors came in. And we, for us, it was a five-year phase, and that we needed to make that happen smoothly.
Okay, I think we have similar language for St. Paul and Duluth, and we just wanted to hear from you about that. Do you want to let Mr. Doan sit down? So this allows you again to start the phase in without waiting for legislative authority. And do you have any issues with the amendment, Mr. Stoffel or Mr. Dawn?
Madam Chair, Jay Stoffel, Director of the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund. Our issues are much the same as the statewide plans, and our approach to this is much like the TRA. The bill for the St. Paul teachers it includes the Duluth Teachers Plan for this issue. And our factors in our transition period will be the same as the St. Paul Teachers Fund and much like the TRA.
Mr. Dunn.
Madam Chairman, our approach was to work with our actuary to come up with similar tables in terms of rewarding those folks who have a longer tenure and are older. So the table is skewed, but one of the provisions that we wanted to ensure was that there still would be some savings built into the plan once the plan was completed, which we have in our case. It's an estimated 10 basis points of savings. The board has approved the factors as presented to you in our bill, and it is to go into effect upon passage of the bill. We have not sought to have some sort of a delay mechanism with the implementation of our provisions.
Mr. Stoffel, do you have do you experience any savings with this?
Madam Chair, yes, we would experience some small savings. I haven't calculated the exact numbers yet. We're working with the actuary on this issue still, but I would imagine they're going to be something in the neighborhood of what the St. Paul Teachers Fund is experiencing, okay. Somewhere 10 or 20 basis points.
Okay. Senator Murphy, did you want to move the two amendments? The amendment is?
I wanted to move 3A.
3A, and 4A does the same thing for Duluth and St. Paul. You want to do them separately? I think they support it.
I was going to add Duluth and now St. Paul.
Okay.
Fine. And so then it's
3A and the 4A.
TRA, MSRS, PERA, Duluth, and St. Paul.
Right.
So, okay. Madam Chair, I move Amendment 3A and Amendment 4A.
Okay. Any discussion on the amendments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Maybe the last Kumbaya amendment of the night.
Chair, thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Back to the TRA bill, I just want us to have a little discussion about that. Excuse me, Representative Murphy.
Excuse me. Madam Chair, would this bill be better in Omnibus 1?
You mean the amendments we just passed?
The amendments and the...
Yeah, we didn't say which bill it was going in.
I think it should go in Omnibus 1.
Members, as drawn, it was drawn... to Omnibus 2, but this is your judgment, and so it's, if you want to designate.
Madam Chair, I think we've heard and we've had discussion and pretty much consensus, so I think it belongs in Omnibus 1 rather than 2.
Then Senator Murphy moves to reconsider the previous motion to approve the 4A and the 3A amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And Senator Murphy moves the 3A and 4A amendment, but for the Omnibus Bill 1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. All right.
And so that this will be inserted into Omnibus 1, the whole.
Right. Okay, back to the... the TRA bill with the alterations from using the new factors is I'm kind of torn between wanting to get the savings for the fund and being sympathetic, and I think this would probably apply to the other teacher funds as well, and being sympathetic with teachers who've been teaching for 30 or 35 years who... maybe would be better served to leave the teaching profession at age 62 and let some younger teachers come into the profession. And then, on the other side, teachers who do retire early, even though they take a reduced pension fund, can come back into the district as substitute teachers, which might be, you know, very acceptable for them to just work part-time and earn up to $40,000 a year, which I'm sure they would never earn that much as substitutes, but maybe it's a long-term sub. So I guess I'm interested to hear what members are thinking.
Representative
Murphy.
Madam Chair, sometimes they don't take jobs as subs, but they take jobs as consultants. Or
right.
They continue part of their job and not the rest of their job. And
this is yours.
Then the school district, gains from their experience.
Right.
But there's no money going into from the active teacher going into the pension fund.
We have a proposal, huh? There has to be, they have to pay, contribute to the pension fund if they come back part time.
Thank you. It's a tax issue. Charging contributions to retired
and it weakens the whole pension fund.
That's what you're told.
There was Representative Murphy. I was just consulting with Mr. Martin, and there was a proposal, I think, in the St. Paul teachers' proposal that retired teachers who come back to the school district to work would continue to contribute to the pension fund. But there was some. Mr. Martin, would you explain it? Some conflict with the tax code?
Members, the chair is correct. In the St. Paul teacher bill, there was a proposal for reemployed annuitants who come back to the pension fund that there would be a resumption of the making of both employer and employee contributions. It was drawn to the attention of Mr. Dolan, the St. Paul teacher pension fund administrator, by TRA, that there may be some difficulty under the federal tax code, and on that basis we were asked to draw language that would eliminate the member contribution portion of that. There's no problem with the employer contribution part of it, but the member contribution would have to be refundable upon termination. And there's some little logic in charging contributions that are going to be refunded in a year or two after they're taken, just to have them sit in account for that short period of time. So that's our understanding, that there's a tax code question. I'm not sure we've been provided with an actual citation to a code provision or a revenue ruling or a proclamation or similar.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't been able to verify that, but that's what we're told.
So back to my dilemma here is the testimony has said that that this is a big change for teachers in terms of what they're expecting in their retirement, if they do early retirement. And in response to that concern, you know, Ms. Hacking and the other teacher funds have come up with a different proposal. But we do miss the opportunity, given these funds are not fully funded, of some savings. So it's not really it's reducing benefits if we go with the new factors. And Ms. Hacking has argued that with their proposal, it would be basically flat. It could save a little money. It could cost a small amount. And I don't know. Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, I mean, given the situation, I don't know why we wouldn't want to attempt to save some money in the fund to make it more financially sound. And I don't know if you want to entertain this now, but we kind of got past the 2A amendment and went on to 3 and 4. I'm wondering if we still, I guess, may want to look at offering the 2A amendment.
Thank you. You're making that motion?
I'll move it,
Senator Thompson,
and I'd be interested to hear discussion on it.
Moves the TA amendment. We might want to change that date, though, because the funds did, Mr. Bergstrom at least, did say it would be impossible to implement. Do you have an alternative date, Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, I thought the amendments that you just adopted were alternative dates.
That was the alternative to the 2A.
Again, so 2A would make us amend it, put it in by July 1 of 2013. If we put a date of July 1 of 2014, that'll give us time to notify without any phase in. Then people will start rushing for the door, and we'll see more and more retirements, and our litigation risk comes out. So I thought the amendments that you adopted were the alternative to the 2A amendment.
Ms. Hacking, what is the ramification if we do nothing on Senate File 529? Think about it. Wait a year.
Madam Chair, just to clarify the question, to reiterate what Mr. Bergstrom said, we need that the other amendment that you just passed.
And we passed that
okay.
in Omnibus Bill 1. That's
if
done.
It's just with respect to the bill,
yes.
We'd have more time to work on this if you did not pass it this year. Our preference is for it to be passed this year. But this does affect mostly post-89 hires, and most of them are still in the pipeline, so to speak. So if it were delayed, we could work further on a solution. But our preference is to pass it this year.
Members, I'm not sure we're going to get done tonight because there are still some unresolved issues with other bills on the agenda. And we were probably going to have to meet post-deadline in 2 weeks after the break. So I would at least like to lay this bill over, and at least for 2 weeks, possibly for next year. So I'm going to lay the bill over. And let's move on then to Senate File 1235, House File 1330, the Duluth teachers' proposal.
Madam Chair.
Senator Murphy.
As you said, there's some issues that still have to be resolved.
So
I suggest that we move on.
And not even discuss it?
Not even discuss it with both bills? Not even.
Do you want to just take up Omnibus 1 then? Let's do that. Should we at least explain the issues to the members? We haven't discussed these bills at all. It would be good if we just explained it to the members.
The
proposal. And so they can at least think about it. What Duluth is proposing, what St. Paul's proposing. Because I'm worried we haven't had any discussion at all on these bills. And if we have to make a decision, we're going to make some kind of decision. I think we should at least do that. I'm just not going to. Okay, members, let's hear the Duluth proposal. And I've been just consulting on this with Representative Murphy that we probably will not vote on this proposal tonight. We need to have a little more discussion, a little more work. But Mr. Stoffel, if you want to come forward and explain the proposal so members know what it is, we could adopt the amendment and discuss it some more. But we have another 7A amendment. There's a 7A amendment to lower the COLA. Mr. Stoffel, did you want us to adopt a 7A amendment, or do you want to just explain the proposal first?
Madam Chair, I'll do a very brief summary of the bill.
Okay,
and
go ahead.
And just to review what we did last week, we took up a delete all amendment.
Can you say your name again for
Jay Stoffel, Director of the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund. And last week, there was a delete all amendment that was moved and passed. And what that would do was increase the employee contribution rate by 1% to equalize with the TRA at 7.5%. Increase the employer contribution rate by 0.71% to equalize with the TRA at 7.5%. Reinstate a 2% cost of living adjustment for the retirees of the plan, again, to equalize with the TRA. Increase the pension multiplier, the benefit multiplier, from 1.7% per year to 1.9% per year, and again, to equalize with the TRA. All of that would come with state aid payment of $8 million per year. A couple other small features would be to have employer contributions on re-employed annuitants and also to have a forfeiture of the penalty amount for those reemployed annuitants when they earn over $46,000. Okay. Madam Chair, that's a summary of the legislation. The delete all amendments.
We don't even have that.
And if you'd like the 7A amendment, does something...
Okay, go ahead with the 7A amendment.
Madam Chair, last week you asked us to come back with ideas, and following your Tuesday hearing, we had a board meeting on Wednesday, and the board agreed that it was a difficult discussion, wasn't easy, but the board did agree that if necessary, we would be agreeable to going from a 2% cost of living adjustment to a 1%, and the state aid would go from $8 million a year to $6 million a year to compensate for that reduction in the cost of living adjustment, so that would be approved by the board if necessary. Again, not an easy discussion, but.
Right, I agree. These are all hard decisions, and you've got a difficult situation in Duluth with a declining demography. And level of the fund. Does anyone want to move the 7A amendment? Senator Johnson moves the 7A amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay. Is there any discussion on the Duluth proposal?
Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To our testifiers, I went back and I reviewed some of the material from previous presentations to the Pension Commission regarding the Duluth Teachers Pension Fund, and went back to March 5th of 2010 when you were before this commission. I actually have it, and I'm sure I don't need to, but I could actually play it for the folks. And basically your speech goes as this: these were difficult things that we need to make, the decisions that we had to make. But this was 2010. We're only 3 years away from that. We had a good year in 11, not so good year in 10, 12, not appreciably better off in terms of where the fund's at. And back then, your statement before this commission was a tough decision, but we need to move that we go to a 0% cost of living raise until we get this fund up to 80%. And I could play the whole thing to you, but it was 0 to 80, and 1 to 90, and then over 100, you know, it goes to CPI up to 5%. So, where in the actuarial science did we make a leap in 3 years to where now you're before us in your first bill? And I'm glad that you came back with 7A, you know, to bend that down, but where do we gain some confidence with all the other evidence you presented in terms of the hardships in your fund? Do we say that even the 1% is something that's warranted at this time when just 3 years ago, in your own testimony, you said we need to keep it at 0 until 80?
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I will not ask you to replay the tape, and I will not dispute what you have reported. At the time, our thinking was, as you report, managing pension funds is a moving target, and things change. I think what we're looking at today, in hindsight, is we're paying a lot of attention to the equity of the situation. The Duluth teachers took a 1% increase in contributions in 2010. They're taking another 1% increase in contributions in this bill, and to have 3 years of no cost of living adjustment has made a difference. It's made a large impact. Our investment portfolio returned 15% in calendar year 2012. So there are things that are happening, things that have been put in motion that are improving the condition of the plan. Our demographics are working against us. We acknowledge that. But this isn't 2010. This is 2013. And I think what we're focusing on is the equity of this situation. This has been a healthy fund for decades. We have had little need for state aid. And because of a global economic crisis, we are in a very difficult situation. And we are asking for assistance. We're asking for consideration to equity for Duluth teachers, for Duluth retirees, to have no cost of living adjustment for this group of people. It stands out. All the funds in January 1st, 2013, paid out a cost of living adjustment. We did not. The funds all have challenges. We have our challenges, and we're asking to be treated or to consider the equity of the situation that we're in.
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Johnson. I'm an attorney representing the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund Association. Somewhere on that tape of 2010, when there was discussion of the COLA, there was questioning at the time whether what was being proposed at the time was too draconian, considering what other funds were doing that had similar unfunded liability programs problems. That testimony stuck out to me, and the reason I remember it isn't because I went back and listened to the tape, but in a long time that I've spent monitoring the Pension Commission, was one of the few times that I'd ever heard something that was being proposed by one of the funds to be considered too draconian to the members. And I'd be happy to go back and find those comments as well. The argument, understanding the actuarial considerations after 3 years of not having a COLA and having other pension funds that are doing something to help the retirees, and the diminishing value of their ability to provide the necessary goods and services of a pension, we feel that on an equitable basis, we ought to be treated like all the other funds that are doing something. We went back to the board because the 2% was something that failed actuarially, and in the discussions we've had with members was too much, and that's why we went back to the lower number. But the rationale for doing something is basically to be equitable with what's going on with the other funds who are in similar situations.
Madam Chair.
Senator Benson. Representative Benson.
Every time I come here, I get a promotion.
I like this place. We do it back and forth.
I tell it what you wish for.
I understand negotiations and how things work. But in this case, you know, the science is more me too rather than it's really there. And I would suggest that the coming back to the table with the 1% was more of the pushback that you received. And I thank you for that. But nevertheless, I don't think it's based on actuarial science. And I think we're going to make decisions around going to Me Too and some other elements rather than does it really help the best interest of this plan long term. I mean, you got people that are absolutely counting on this in 10, 20, 30 years from now that we have to make decisions around this table to make sure that that's going to happen. And you know, I know you're getting a lot of pressure. That's how it works, being in that level of responsibility regarding, you know, we didn't get one. But the fact is, the health of this plan is important. And ultimately, when we make a decision, that's what we've got to consider. You came before us 3 years ago saying that we're in such bad shape that we're willing to forego that. And I have the 22 minutes. And I remember the other comments about those issues being draconian. And I could also suggest that you said that the 1% that you're here at the table now was too tough. And I'm not going to ask you, but I mean, what's changed? And I think it's because you know the science well enough to know that you guys are in tough shape. And when and if we get to voting on this, my suggestion is that I know that it's too late in the season right now to make the suggestion, and we've got to deliberate plenty regarding what's it going to take to look at a merger. But we've got to consider that. My hope is that you're serious about those conversations, and I know that whoever's the gaining person in this, we're going to have to work. We're going to have to work hard. But you all are going to have to work hard and make sure that you're really covering the interest of all those folks.
Well, I think we do have to be concerned about the Duluth teachers, and the demographics of the district is of concern in terms of the viability of the pension fund. So I hate to do this again, members, but thank you for your efforts. in this regard, but I think we need to think about it a little bit more. Okay, let's see where we're at with the St. Paul Fund.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. We had testimony. Sorry. Mr. Bannion wants to testify, and we have two others.
His name is pronounced
Trinan. Mr. Bannion.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. And you've done a good bit for the tape again, King Bannion, St. Cloud State University, and senior fellow at the Center of the American Experiment. And I want to thank you I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for understanding that this does need more work. I do think that Representative Benson has raised some good points. I've also listened to this 25 or 27 minutes of conversation from March 5th, 2010, and there was a significant discussion about the cost of living adjustments. One of the things I point out is TRA at the time, when it went through that process, had a zero adjustment for 2 years and then moved up. But let's also remember that they added 2% to their employer and employee contribution as opposed to 1%. For Duluth, so they've stepped up in another way. And there was something on that tape that had really interested me, and I think actually Representative Murphy, my good friend, it was you who said it, you talked about, you know, how Duluth is going through this time where the demographics are changing. Oh, I live in St. Cloud. We're going through the same types of things. We've got a district that's shrinking in our area. And I think to myself, okay, at the time we did it, we talked about, well, you know, why not 2% as your contribution increase, like you're doing with TRA? And the discussion was, and I think your words were, Representative Murphy, were something the effect of it's just one straw too many on the camel's back. And I listened to that, and I thought that's in fact correct. But let's remember, members, that this proposal you have before you adds that straw onto the camel's back now, and I guess I don't know exactly what's going on with the demographics in Duluth, but I can tell you for St. Cloud, they're not getting any better. If anything, they're getting a little bit worse. And I think it would be harder to put that additional 1% on now even than it was in 2010. So I look at what we've done here and think to myself, you know, really there was conversation at that time that maybe the more viable option was simply to merge them into TRA. I do believe that, and my discussion with you would be simply that conversation that you put off 3 years ago may have been just a bridge too far. It's just not, you were doing so much in 2010. It was just too hard. It was too big a lift for you at that time. You have time. You know, this fund has trouble, but you got another year to think about it. And it may be, in fact, noting from your budget, at least from the House's budget this year, that there's a $52 million add item on the budget on the line for credits, pensions, and other bills. Perhaps there's money there as well already to do what you really need to do, which is to have that long think about what to do with this in the long term. You're back 3 years after you thought you'd dealt with this in 2010. You're dealing with it again. And what would be a real shame is if you do something now, you spend $6 million a year, and 3 years from now, you're doing this yet again. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bannion. Mr. Trinan. Oh, and Mr. Rapensky, you're together.
Madam Chair, Commission members, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you tonight. My name is Tom Trinan. I'm a retired elementary school principal from Duluth, Minnesota.
And I'm Greg Rapensky, also a retired school principal from Duluth.
Right. We have three quick things we'd like to bring to your attention this evening. And one regards House File 1330, the other is Senate File 1235. With no offense meant towards either Representative Murphy or Senator Reinert, we know that Duluth faces a very serious pension fund difficulty challenge these days, and we appreciate any support you can give us in Duluth to deal with that. We do, however, want to express our strong objection to solving this problem at the expense of the children in the Duluth public schools. Every year, the last 5 years of my career and all the years since I've retired, every year it's how many million dollars need to be cut out of the Duluth Public Schools budget. We have burgeoning class sizes. Educational opportunities for students have been diminished. And in 2010, as part of the effort to work with the pension fund, there was probably a $500,000 to $600,000 additional cost to the school board, which actually translates into a cut to services for children, probably 8 to 9 teachers at that time. And with the proposal, there would be an additional 0.75% cut from the Duluth Public Schools budget, about $350,000, amounting to a cut if you just cut teachers, another 5 teachers. So we would like to ask that as we're thinking about other things that we consider not increasing the cost of education, educating students in Duluth by another $350,000 at this time.
Our second point.
Mr. Rapinski.
On. Thank you. Senator Pappas, senators and representatives. Our second point is a proposal to move the state pension funds towards solvency and provide some level of equity to various retiree cohorts. I'd reference you to Table A and Table B. And really, Table B is a summary of the last 35 years and the increases in the Minnesota public pension plans. And Table A really then is a summary of those increases from the years 1996 to 2002. In the left-hand column are the annual increases, and in the right-hand column are the cumulative increases. And you notice that during those 7 years, the consumer price index increased 19.2%, yet the benefits, MSRS para TRA increased 76.8%. That's 4 times the consumer price index. You'll see that Duluth teachers increased 60% during that time, while the consumer price index increased 19.2%. These increases not only delivered a crushing blow to our state pension funds, but they also created huge disparities in what this retiree cohort received. It also has a severely impacts future retiree cohorts. What I'd like to reference you to quickly is Table C. There's page 1 and 1 of 2 and 2 of 2. And if you lay those on the side of each other, you'll notice that if in 25 years, starting with a 2001 retiree with an annual 2% COLA, that person would earn about $756,833. You notice down below the net present value that compared to a 2009 retiree, that retiree would earn an additional amount of money. When you you'll notice that when you get to the year a retiree of 2% COLA, when you come across, you'll notice that the difference is about $245,000 increase for a person who retired in 1994 as compared to a person who retires in 2010 for 25 years. And when you look at the bottom line, it's a difference of about $286,000. There's not equity there. And so we would further propose we bring some level of equity to this situation. We'd like to suggest that retirees who received way above the consumer price index cost of living increases have their monthly pensions maintained at their current level, with available funds being directed to recent retirees retirees who have really seen their net present value negatively affected by the 2010 legislation.
And I will just add to that,
Mr. Trinan.
Oh, excuse me, Madam Chair. Excuse me, members.
That's it. Proceed.
This, of course, is just based on what has happened so far. And if there are additional 0% increases, this wasn't part of what we were going to say, but there's a pretty serious effect to people who have retired more recently, and any consideration that could be given there would be appreciated. Mm. And, Madam Chair, to our third point.
Okay, Mr. Rapinski. I'm just wondering if that's if you can do that. You know, simple question about can you give a COLA to more recent retirees and not give it to people who retired 15, 20 years ago? 15, 20 years ago, are they still alive?
I would certainly have to refer that to perhaps Mr. Martin or other folks. I am not familiar so much with how that's done.
Okay. Well, do your third point anyway, Mr. Okay. Rapinski.
In the third point,
Mr. Trident.
Madam Chair, members, is that we feel it's imperative that there be a – in this, I don't want to – I hope I'm not offending anybody here. That is not the point. But that there be a pension review audit committee put in place that would annually give you as committee members their recommendation regarding all state pension funds. And I don't know if it would be the state auditor or who that would be in conjunction with members on this committee and Mr. Martin. But – state pension funding and the ramifications surrounding it are very complicated, and it takes a great deal of dedicated time and expertise really to fully understand all that's involved. You as bright and capable senators and representatives have many, many things you need to learn about and many different areas you need to deal with on a day-to-day basis. Having a group dedicated to looking specifically at state pension funds on an annual basis would provide you with the information you need as you make critical decisions about our state pension funds, which ultimately affect all of us as Minnesotans as we depend on the critical government services that our state government provides. According to data from the Minnesota Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement and Mr. Martin's office, our current pension fund liability is $16.7 billion. And it's that amount if we use the actuarial return basis of 8%. So going forward, and Mr. Martin, I'd ask you to jump in here if I'm saying this wrong. If pension funds earn 8%, we'll remain at $16.7 billion in the negative. If a bull market occurs, of course, that number would go down. But if we go anywhere below 8%, that liability number is going to increase in the wrong direction. Our opinion is that the liability needs to be taken a very quick and thoughtful approach so that as we move forward as a state, we can do so on solid financial footing. And those are our comments. I appreciate your attention and would ask if you have any questions of us.
Thank you very much. Very thoughtful comments. We appreciate your input here. Any questions from the members? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Doan, if we could just do a quick review of St. Paul, and then we're going to move on to this one. Mr. Doan,
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and members of the Commission. My name is Paul Doan. I serve as the Executive Director of the St. Paul Teacher Retirement System. The package that has been distributed to you is similar to the one that presented last time, other than the adjustments that are made there on page 4 to the report. And I can quickly walk through some of the changes that have resulted in the proposal from our conversation at the hearing a week ago and related events. You'll recall that at that hearing, Madam Chairman, there were some issues raised both from your commission members relative to the financial state aid request at the same time, the St. Paul School Administration voiced some concerns about the impact to the return-to-work program that the administration sees as a very valuable component in its filling appropriate teacher positions. And we're not intending to make that more difficult. What we are attempting to do with the return-to-work program is to at least from a funding standpoint, not have it be a detriment to the system, which it has been in the past due to the fact that employers at this point and employees that are active members would be contributing, and if they're retired members, they're non-contributing. So I worked with representatives of the administration, and I think we've worked out a package that is acceptable to the school district. And I've incorporated those provisions into the package in front of you on page 4. And at the same time, we've reflected some of the comments from members of the commission relative to the dynamic program that we had proposed and presenting it more in a fixed rate so that there is a fixed amount that would not be variable from year to year based upon the investment return as we had proposed. And in this way, maybe the budgeting process, if the legislature sees fit to provide the additional aid, would have a set amount. So I'll walk you quickly through that and then try to address questions that the commission may have. Again, the recent evaluation of the fund indicated a 6.4% of salary deficiency that needed to be addressed at some point, and certainly as has been raised today, acting sooner rather than later is certainly advantageous. And I don't think anything in this proposal is anything more than a very concerned effort on the part of the Board of the St. Paul Teachers Retirement System to put together a package that is fair, balanced, and sufficient to address the funding issues that face this system. So we're looking at the need to come up with a 6.4% of salary. That translates into a little less than $17 million annually. The first section there are steps that the St. Paul Teachers System has taken or is in the process of taking. One of them relates to format change, in essence, in the way certain things are computed relative to the valuation. And our actuary, Gabriel Roeder, has agreed with the Commission's actuaries at Milliman with this suggestion, and that will save the system 40 basis points. The Board approved, and the legislature has implemented a program that is still being placed or put into effect, which will increase the contribution rates over the next 2 years for both employees and employers, and that will result in an additional 1% of salary. And in addition, you have before you a proposal that was presented last year to the Commission. A table was inaccurately included, and this is a procedural step to put in the correct table relative to a more correct analysis of the salary growth, and that would save the system with this new table 120 basis points. And that roughly translates into approximately $7 million of the $17 million that is needed. In addition, the board has taken further action, which are identified there in the middle group of references. One is a modification of the return to work program that we talked about, and this is in consultation with the school board, continuing consultation with the school board, and agreement on different features. Elimination of the excess earnings is not new. The collection of employer contributions will take place. It will originally, we were also talking about a possible employee, but that's already been discussed by the commission, so we're limiting it to the employer contribution. And we're extending the separation of service period. It was 180 days, as we had initially recommended, and in consultation with the school board, we've reduced that to 90 days. For those provisions will save an approximately 5 basis points.
I got it.
Of salary. The second one is the adoption of the revised formula that will determine early retirement reduction table, which we talked about earlier this evening. That will save the system 10 basis points, according to our actuary's estimates. The third step will be a further increase
in the early retirement table is saving the district. It's not costing.
It'll save. It'll provide a savings of 10 basis points.
Is this similar to what TRA is doing, though?
And well, our system, in essence, the tables are not terribly dissimilar, but we tried to make them such that in our calculations, I asked the actuary to come up with a methodology that would actually still result in some savings to the system.
And if
so the numbers aren't exactly parallel, but the concept is the same.
If you went with the new factors, would you experience more savings?
Yes.
Do you know what that would be?
The new factor in terms of the actual equivalent?
Right.
I'd estimate that would be around 75 basis points.
Okay. Mr. Doan, is all these changes you're talking about, is that in the 12A and the 13A amendments?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry I interrupted you. Do you want to just complete?
The final points was that there is an increase in here of an additional 1% that will bring the employee and employers it'll bring into the system an additional 2 basis points, in essence, of salary. There is a provision in here. It will also bring employees up to parity with what the teacher retirement system teachers contribute, which would be 7.5%. It's a slight adjustment based upon discussions we had with St. Paul that the contribution increases from the employer will be phased in over 3 years rather than the 2 years as we had originally proposed. And there is an increase in there for the in the multiplier effect for determination of years of service and retirement credit. That does result in a cost to the system of 85 basis points, but as I mentioned last time, that's a cost that is more than offset by the increase in employee contributions. The net effect of those changes would be to raise an additional $3.4 million annually. And the balance is remains what we've requested now, a fixed amount of $7 million in terms of state aid, which is slightly less than the average what we had put last time as a estimate of what we would potentially receive. So that is the package with the modifications based upon last week's hearing and conversations with interested parties.
Okay, well, why don't we put on the 12A and the 13A amendment. Representative Lesch, would you like to move that?
I would, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesch moves the 12A and the 13A amendment be added to the St. Paul Pension Bill, 1249 in the Senate, and 1433 in the House. Any questions on the amendments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Any questions for Mr. Doan? We have a testifier, Mr. Bannion. Mr. Thompson. I'm sorry. Senator Thompson, you have a question for Mr. Doan?
I do, actually. Right. Sorry, I was slow on the uptake there. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Doan, if I do my math correctly, if you look at the line number 4 on your page 4 there, the increased multiplier, that would have an impact, if I'm doing my percentages correctly, of about 2.6 million dollars. Is that correct? Because there's essentially a net gain of 1.3% if you add up all 1, 2, and 3 and subtract out 4, which gets it to 3.4 million. So if I did my math right, that 0.85 to the negative there is worth about 2.6 million. Is that right? Does that look right to you?
Madam Chairman, Senator Thompson, the number it would be 85 basis points of the school's total salary, which is about $260 million. So the 85 basis points ends up being about 2.2 million, something like
okay,
that.
Okay, thank you. So if that weren't in there, if we just kept the multiplier the same, that would generate another 2.2 million toward fixing the problem, right?
Senator Thompson, that would be correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Doan, you're asking for this proposal tonight that you're presenting tonight for an additional $7 million?
Madam Chairman, that is correct.
And how long will it take you to get up to 80% with that rate of aid?
Madam Chairman, in the report, we have had a projected table from our actuary, which demonstrates that with the different levels of state funding, estimated dates in which we would achieve 80%. So based upon that table, I would say sometime around 2030 or something in that range, 2032, possibly at $7 million.
And, Mr. Doan, do you expect that by 2030 you will be with the same demographics that you are presented today?
Madam Chairman, these are calculated with the estimates in terms of the demographics of the system in place. I can't attest whether it's today we have about 3,800 active employees and about 2,900 retirees. People are living longer, so the retiree, but at the same point, the school district has been a growing school district, so the relative relationship, let's say, of actives to retirees probably will narrow, but appreciably these numbers are presented with that understanding in mind, that they have estimated what that relationship will be. If you want a specific number, I can refer to our actuary who's in the room, and maybe she would have that number on hand. I'm not sure. I have not asked her what the breakdown would be in 2032, but Minnesota's a growing state, and St. Paul's an attractive place to be, and I have every reason to believe that the school district will continue to grow and be profitable and to the benefit of the retirement system.
I certainly hope that that's true, Mr. Doan.
Well, we think Duluth is also a very attractive place to live.
But Madam Chair?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Doan, we just noticed we think might be an error on page 4 of your handout.
Oh, okay.
Under number 3B, that the 2016 should be 0.5%. Is that correct?
Correct. Sorry. As I could walk through that, the school thank you, Madam Chairman, for pointing that out. We were trying to make some changes here, and unfortunately that was a gaffe on our part. The employee contributions would be proposed to increase once the current increases terminate in fiscal year 2015 by 0.5% each of 2016 and fiscal year 2017. The school employer portion would be phased in over a three-year period. The first year of that three-year period, 2016, would be 0.5%, and the 2017 and 2018 years would be at 0.25% for a total of 1%.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for pointing that out, Madam Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Doan, why is it okay to phase in that? amounts, those amounts?
Mr. Dunn.
Madam Vice Chairman, could you repeat the question, please?
Yes. Why is a phase-in period for those amounts okay to your plan?
Mr. Dunn.
Madam Chairman, Madam Vice Chairman, the proposal here has us increasing those quarter percent contributions currently for the next 2 years. So once those are completed, then another set of contribution increases would take place. And that's why the idea was to get this phased in as prudently and as quickly as possible, and that was believed to be a prudent approach, where we would phase in that remaining 1% over a 2-year period for the employees. So they'll in essence pay a quarter of a percent next year, a quarter percent the following year, half a percent the following year, and a half a percent that following year.
And
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Doan, Senator Pappas, St. Paul employees deserve more consideration than maybe employees in other parts of the state? That's just, you don't have to comment. Please don't comment, Mr. Doan.
I actually wish our school districts didn't have to have these pension costs, because I'm sympathetic with the previous gentleman who testified about the impact on the Duluth School District.
Madam Chairman, I just would comment, if I might, and that is these would bring the St. Paul School District, I just want to make sure the Commission is aware, in parity with the contributions of other teachers, and it's important that the benefit structure and the contributions paid are comparable in order to ensure that teachers don't sort of forum shop or school shop for positions. And would like to think that a teacher in St. Paul is worth every bit the teacher in Bloomington or wherever, and for that reason this would accomplish a provision that hasn't been in place previously. So that's the motivation behind moving in this direction and those amounts, and at the same point accomplishing a very important purpose.
Mr. Doan, I don't think you talked about this last week, but on page 7 of your handout, you talk a little bit about the cost of consolidation. I think that's on everyone's mind. So do you want to just walk us through page 7?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. You know, I had the privilege of spending a considerable amount of time in the legislature, and as a cost-conscious member of that legislature, I always wanted to make sure that we were doing things that were prudent and cost-effective. And one of the features of the proposal was to sort of say, well, we are asking for a lot of money from the state. What is the option? Would it be less expensive or more expensive if we were to take the tack that all of the good works of the St. Paul School District over the and the school retirement system over the last 104 or 5 odd years have been okay, but let's shift it into TRA. So we did our analysis with the help of our actuary, and I think some important numbers are included here, and it just demonstrates that there are sort of three factors that go into, among others potentially, but certainly three factors that would go into some cost of consolidation. One factor would be the cost of dealing with the existing unfunded liability, because certainly TRA is not going to take a system in and incur their liabilities any more than if you were taking over some company and agreed to not cover any debts that you would incur by taking over such a company. Same situation here. The debt that we have is of roughly $560 million. If you prorate that over the 25-year period that we're talking about here in terms of state funding and assistance to the system, That 25-year period, amortizing that $560 million, results in a number of about $36 or $37 million a year cost to the system. Now, we take in about $40 million or so in benefits, but most of that is aimed at dealing with the employee share, which is the normal cost, or what needs to be set aside for the current employees. The balance of that is available to be used to pay the long-term liability, or this $560 million. That would translate into roughly $18 million of the 36 that's needed. So 18 is still needed, and that would be a state cost. The second item would be that if you leave the systems as they are currently in place, it would be necessary for the benefits of St. Paul teachers who would become part of the TRA system to receive the same benefits of other members of the teacher retirement system, and the same for retired members of the system. So the COLA with the TRA is different than the COLA with St. Paul, and it would have to be elevated to the teacher retirement level from 1 to 2. And multiplier and benefit system for active teachers would have to also be increased to the same level that TRA is at. That is about an $11 million annual cost to make those adjustments to our system. And the third factor is we do have a roughly a $940 million investment portfolio. There is a cost to wind that down to cash to turn over to the state board, and for the state board to then reinvest that money in a manner that they want to invest it in, or in investments that they particularly own. I've estimated that the cost of that would be an additional $100,000 to $125,000 a year, amortized over that 25-year time span. So the comparative numbers that we've come up with for our system to be folded into TRA would cost roughly $30 million a year for the next 25 years to the state versus the proposal that we have before you, which is roughly a third of that cost. And we do have a system that is administratively run well. Its investment return has been very strong, and we have every reason to believe that with making up for many past faults through the past years, and primarily as a result of that unfunded, historic, sort of underfunded liability, that's what we're having to deal with today. It's not dealing with the current workforce. Those employees are more than meeting their obligations for the future. It's the past obligations that we unfortunately have to be dealing with today, and the ability of our system to do it on its own with the state system, with the state's assistance here, will achieve it much more efficiently than if you were to fold our plan into the TRA plan.
And Mr. Dillon, this picture is current law. Have you can you estimate at all, or have you done any analysis, if we pass your bill with the revised employer-employee increases and with the revised benefit increases, how that would impact this $30 million a year?
Madam Chairman, what you would then do is you would reduce that $11 million. You would remove that $11 million because now we would be even.
Mm-hmm.
But that's this $11 million or so we're trying to make up here. So that's kind of a wash, but there still would remain the roughly $18 million or so that would not be addressed and would have to be made up in some fashion.
So if we were to pass your bill after the phase-in, which is 2016 or something, is it 2016?
Yes.
Then at that point, if consolidation was discussed, that's when it would be the $18 million a year cost.
Madam Chairman, that would approximately be correct, yes.
Okay. Testimony. Questions, first of all, from members? Testimony. Mr. Bannion.
Thank you once again, Madam Chair. members. I think the question you need to ask yourself is, why would you treat this conversation differently than you treat the conversation that you just had over the Duluth Fund? Wouldn't equity ask you to treat them the same way? If you read the staff report, I keep going back to these because they are quite telling and interesting. The question really does arise again. Why not think about the merger? This is discussed in this is Mr. Burrick, who's written your memo to you about this particular bill. And I would point you to pages 2 and 3 upon it, particularly the paragraph below the information. This is a fund that has a funding ratio currently of 62%. It gets 62%, as Mr. Burke points out in the memo. I didn't know this until I read it. In a most interesting way, it has a 25-year rolling amortization, mm-hmm. meaning that you keep rolling over your amortization every year as if you're starting over again. There is no other fund that does it this way. It is something that's not addressed in this bill and might be a place where you would look, even if you wanted to keep St. Paul separate, you would probably want to look at why do we do it that way. And sure, there's historical precedent there. I'm not sure what it is, but let me call your attention in short to make it short because I've been up here already twice and I don't wish to burden you too much. But call your attention on page 3 to the paragraph below the data on the fund, in which Mr. Burrick has reviewed the history of MRF and of Minneapolis teachers. And the fact that we've put money into those funds in the past and then eventually that didn't work out, they had to come back another time, and eventually you decided to go ahead with merger. You're better off if you're going to think that a merger is possible someplace down the road, you save money by doing it now rather than later. You've already opened up the possibility of a conversation to talk about that during the summer and fall and coming back next year to it. I think that's a good choice you made regarding Duluth. I think it's a good choice that you could make as well with St. Paul. People will know from my time here in the legislature, I'm not the biggest fan of defined benefit plans. That's not the point in this particular piece. I hope at some point to talk to you about alternatives to thinking about going toward defined contribution, as I know my colleague Kim Crockett at the Center of the American Experiment has done for you. But I think your wise motion is to continue in the same way, discussing the same thing you did with Duluth, taking these plans together and asking yourself, is this the point in time in which we should do these? And if so, shouldn't we do both of them rather than just one and not the other? And I'll just leave you with that and stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bannion. Any questions? Anyone else wants to testify on the St. Paul proposal? All right, we're going to set that aside. Yes, Senator Murphy. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, one question did come up in my mind based on a previous conversation that we had. And I see Mr. Rice is here, too. And the other plans that are seeking some kind of assistance or state aid. And I would just like to ask the question, if I may proceed.
Please, Representative Murphy.
Would any of you be willing to come to the table and tell me your reaction about what you think about if the state aid money that you are receiving, whether it's through surcharges or whether it's a general fund grant in aid or whether it's a city local government aid added to relieve your situation, to bring the liabilities up or down, down, I guess, to address the problems. What would you think about if the state portion of the state aid was not invested in the way you have been investing, but through the State Board of Investments rather than through your portfolios. And I would welcome if Mr. Banyan wanted to comment, I'd appreciate that too, because I have some thinking to do, apparently.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Representative Murphy, for the question. I've followed the Pension Commission now for over 30 years, and I think I've privately told all of you this, but I would say it publicly. If you take all state and local government spending in this state and factor in what's spent for pensions, Minnesota spends 1.6% of every dollar raised state and locally on pensions. The national average is 2.9%. Minnesota has among the lowest ratio of expenditures for public pensions of any state in the country. They're extremely well-run plans in general. This Pension Commission has paid very close attention to pension funding issues over the years, and it's been extremely difficult to find resources to fund these plans historically. There have been aid programs, Representative Murphy, as you've pointed out, when the issue of local police and fire consolidation came up in the 1980s. The legislature set aside money to address those consolidations. There were 47 police and fire relief associations, and as of last year, all of those plans consolidated with the PRA police and fire plan. There have been other consolidations that have happened over the years with MRF. That's still ongoing, but they're under PRA's administration now, Minneapolis Teachers with the TRA plan. In both of those cases that were recent history, the legislature was asked and responded to situations where, in MRF's case, it was been a closed plan for over 25 years. They had no new members coming in. I believe the state contributed at that time in excess of $20 million a year for a period of 25 years to help pay off that unfunded liability. Similarly, when the Minneapolis Teachers Plan was consolidated with TRA, that remained an active plan that did have some demographic challenges. That consolidation, I believe, cost $22 million in state general funds to accomplish that consolidation. For a combined total in Minneapolis of close to $45 million a year in general fund aid that's now programmed to go into those plans, TRA and PRA, that's in their base planning document. Similarly, those police and fire aids are now also planned and go in to the PRA police and fire fund and are part of the actuarial valuation numbers that you get and are essentially dollars that are there, and those plans are relying on to pay off past liabilities projected into the future. I think, and I represent the St. Paul Teachers plan is getting an appropriation of approximately $3 million currently from aid that was generated in the 1990s. That's in a categorical aid, and that's part of all of these assumptions. I don't think it would be possible to go back in the past and reprogram those aids. You'd have to talk to each of the fund directors of TRA and PRA for both the general plan with MRF and the PRA police and fire plan, but my understanding of that is those aid dollars are in their base budget numbers, and undoing that would cause other problems for their plans, creating other contribution deficiencies. With respect to the aid proposal going forward, I do think it's an important question because that is the request of both Duluth and St. Paul. But I think as Mr. Doan presented the case, it's much more, in my opinion, economical to provide that aid to this plan and keep it an active open plan and get it funded than it would be to do a consolidation with TRA. I think the cost is at least two or three times as much to effectuate a consolidation similar to the Minneapolis Teachers Plan. The Duluth situation, I think, is a little different because of some of the demographics up there. St. Paul is the largest school district in the state with a little over 39,000 students. And it has been a stable, if even growing, district in recent years. It's a plan that's outperformed the State Board of Investment over the last 10 years by 0.2%. It ranks in the top 10% of plans nationally in terms of its investments. And documents that Mr. Martin prepared for you earlier this year showed that their benefits for St. Paul teachers have been less than the other statewide plans because they did take a two-year freeze in their COLA back when a pension fix was needed, and they have a 1% COLA. And historically, they've trailed the COLAs granted to the larger plans, and their formula is also less. So I think that there's a each of these plans, I think, has a unique story that the Pension Commission needs to look at and say what's the wisest choice on how to proceed forward. I do think, in general, from every consolidation that I've seen where there's been a direct rescue, paying off that current unfunded liability, the expectation in para was, police and fire, was always if you consolidated, your city had to pay the freight. There were no, we'll take you in and we'll absorb your costs, because then it becomes unfair to every other legislator around the table that their communities are shouldering a burden that's greater than another community. I think that was recognized when the MRF consolidation happened, because the city of Minneapolis, not only did the state put in money, but the city had to put in significant dollars to effectuate that consolidation. And the fairness issue is an important one. I might just say for the record, St. Paul Schools and the city is already contributing well in excess of any other school districts are to address their problem. If the bill were to pass, they would be about 10.5% of salary base. School districts around the state pay 7.5%. And that's not even, it would get the plan on track and fund it. I also think that the commission has heard that, but the St. Paul Teachers Plan is the oldest existing plan now in the state. And in 1957, again from the document Mr. Martin prepared to the staff, in 1957, when some of the statewide plans were 50 or 60% funded, St. Paul was 9% funded. In 1970, the St. Paul Teachers Plan was 20% funded, while the statewide plans were about 60% funded. And if you look at the history of this plan and the funding ratio, the highest this plan ever got was 80% funded, while all of the larger plans at some point were at or above 100% funded. So the problems endemic, or the problems particular to St. Paul, have not been management, have not been expenses, have not been benefits relative to other parts of the state. There's been this long legacy cost. It was a pay-as-you-go plan until 1960 or so, and there's a long history that we talked about in the first presentation. So I don't know if I answered your question, Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, say that the Pension Commission recommended that the $7 million be paid to the SBI for investment rather than to the St. Paul.
Madam Chair, that's certainly an option, and they could create an account in there, and the SBI does a great job. I think that's certainly an option. As I said, historically, St. Paul Teachers has outperformed the State Board of Investment. That's not to say they do it again in the future.
Thank you. Is there anyone else?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Murphy, thank you once more. This is an intriguing question. There are a number of there's a number of ways to think about this. The way I'd put it in my own mind is to think about it. Do you want someone locally to control those funds? Do you want State Board of Investment to control those funds? State Board of Investment's done really well. We've been very fortunate with the management of SBI. They've returned above the market for many years. You have to recognize that. But the question really is about, you know,
who is the money and eventually in the benefit for? And the beneficiaries of them are supposed to be the teachers, right? Those are our employees. And so I would posit to you that you consider not only the option of which outside director, but also consider the possibility of self-direction, of the possibility that perhaps what we should do is we should let people decide for themselves what to do with that money. Many years ago, I've been teaching at St. Cloud State since 84.
Don't go there.
Okay.
Don't go that they get to decide for themselves.
Okay, all right.
Previously, you said you weren't going to talk about...
All right, very well. Right. Very well, then.
But you were doing fine up to that.
Thank you so much. Look, again, I mean, the point is you have a fund that works well. My concern for you is SBI, we know many people have had funds that have run very well for many years, and all of a sudden something bad happens. You have people here from Duluth and St. Paul saying, hey, things were going really well, and all of a sudden, boom, 2008 happened, and things went really badly. And you know, the thing to think about is, does anyone remember Joseph Granville? I'll look over at the pension staff. Maybe they remember Joseph Granville. He was a guy who had made great calls in the late 70s and early 80s in terms of where the market was going, and his people were making tons of money, and he used to put on these shows, have people pay $250 to come hear him give advice. He'd ride into this huge hall on an elephant. Okay, and he was so wonderful. Well, Joe Granville made a couple bad calls later on, and the point is, as they always say on those commercials, right? Past performance is no assurance of future returns, and so no matter what, if you decide, well, they've done the best so far, so I think I want to go with them, it's no assurance of where you're going to go in the future.
That's helpful. Thanks.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, then, members, just to finish up, we're going to do Omnibus Bill 1, which is all the non-controversial stuff, and I think we have that in the packet. I feel like we've adopted, when is it here? We've already adopted all these provisions, so unless somebody is really insistent, I don't think we need to go through them again, but we do have some amendments. And Senator Saxon?
Right. I have an amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I present the 14A amendment.
Because I'm mistaken to keep that money.
And while it's being passed out, you want to just explain your amendment?
Well, Madam Chair, I have two testifiers coming up.
All right. The 14A amendment. Who wants to go first? Ms. Bannock.
Madam Chair and members, Mary Bannock, PERA. As some individuals involved in the consolidation of the Minneapolis Firefighters Relief Association were looking at the cleanup bill, they noticed that some provisions had been repealed that they weren't particularly comfortable with. And the amendment before you reinstates language that was in our statute related to the merger of Minneapolis Police and Fire. It essentially makes sure that para staff refers back to the bylaws that were in place on the date of consolidation to govern these relief association member benefits in a way that they were governed before, other than the calculation of benefit that's specifically stated in another part of our law. It also reinstates language that directs us to take insurance premium withholdings from their benefit payments and transfer those to the city of Minneapolis, and to cooperate with the fraternal organizations to ensure that communications are made available to their membership. So it's taking sections of the law that were being repealed and reinstating them in a little bit briefer way and making sure that they will remain part of our statutes.
In this doesn't
and Mr. Fees. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dave Johnson. I'm an attorney representing the Minneapolis Firefighters Fraternal Association. Some of the trustees, including former Representative Dennis Osmond, who is one of the MFFA trustees, was looking at some of the language and some of the repealers. We felt that while the
the intent was there. We felt like we ought to use this as an opportunity to do two things. One is just clarify with respect to the benefits that these individuals had at the time of consolidation, and then to re-add some of the language from the repealer that was prospective. Most of what was contained in some of the repealers related to the process by which the consolidation occurred, and that's over. But these provisions with respect to the authority to take money out of these individuals' amounts for health insurance or dental insurance, that was in the consolidation law, and that's prospective. The language regarding the cooperation between the fraternal association and para perspective as well. So we see this as just clarifying and technical reinstatement language. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any comments or questions? Anyone in the audience want to testify? Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rice. I'm representing the Minneapolis Police Relief Association, successor organization, Police Fraternal Association. And, you know, fortunately, Mr. Osment caught this, and that caused me and Mr. Johnson to review it. I would note that the bill itself repeals the last language that's currently in Paris statute for the last four consolidations, Minneapolis Fire Police, Fairmount, and Virginia. And I would agree and concur that this amendment saves critical provisions of that. But I'd also ask not to hold up tonight's proceeding, that we'd recommend you adopt this, but we may have to more critically review each of those repealers to make sure we're not inadvertently repealing another important provision in each of those four bills. So Senator Rosen's not here tonight, but I work with her on that bill, and that may need some technical fixes too, so that and those bills, Madam Chair, you were involved in that. Senator Rosen carried the Minneapolis Police and Fire one and the last one in the Senate for her city and for Virginia were quite complicated and involved a lot of considerations and negotiations on both the city and the Relief Association side. So we'd support it, and we might need to visit with you and the commission later in the process to make sure we haven't done something that we shouldn't do.
Okay. On the Saxhog Amendment, 14A, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Another amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Members, there are a couple of technical amendments that we're aware of that relate to MSRS and the inclusion of MAPE as an employee, as a in the membership of the in the membership of MSRS General. And then there's also some technical amendments related to the MSRS administrative provisions. So the first amendment that I have for you is the 11A amendment. The concern here is a provision that relates to a current retiree who works for MAPE who would not be in MSRS General. That's really considered to be or expected to be a transitional provision for this one person and not an ongoing proposition. So this simply moves that language out of the codified statutes and puts it in the effective date so that it applies to one person, the current person, and it's not an ongoing proposition.
Any questions on the amendment? Anyone want to testify? All right, then. Senator Saxhog moves the 11A amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Remember, the next amendment this is the 13A amendment, and this has to do with the MSRS administrative provisions that are in the bill. There was a bad citation, which is cleaned up on the amendment, page 1, line 3. And then lines 1-4 and 1-5 are a suggestion from Mr. Bergstrom about the
vestigial legislator's retirement plan, which has a modest amount of assets in it left over from the post-fund dissolution. And when there are investment proceeds on those limited assets, they should be credited to the legislator's retirement fund. They had stricken some language to that effect, which was broader than that, and they did want to keep this portion of that language.
Okay. Representative Murphy moves the 13A amendment. All those in favor? Any questions? And anyone want to testify? All right. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Anything else?
Members, the other thing I have for you is a carryover from a prior meeting. When we did when we looked at the judge's bill, I raised with you a problem that the reviser had flagged for us having to do with benefit accrual rates. The way Minnesota statutes is currently structured is there's a provision in Chapter 356 which specifies a number of benefit accrual rates. The only way you can make any sense out of it is to look at the headnote. And, of course, the headnote is not part of the law. It's there as an illustration or a general direction, but it's not considered to be part of the substantive law. And the reviser would like to either greatly enhance that 356 provision, specifying all the plans that are impacted, or alternatively to go back to actually specifying the benefit accrual rates in the individual pension plan laws. I favor the second approach, since right now you have to read Chapter 352 with one finger stuck in Chapter 356 to find the benefit accrual rates. You can't make sense of the plan without reading the two chapters together. This simply moves the benefit accrual rates to the appropriate place.
Representative Lesch?
You want me to move it, Madam?
Yeah.
Then I do.
Representative Lesch moves the 12A amendment. Any questions, comments? Anyone from the audience? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Members, I believe that's all the amendments that I'm aware of for the Omnibus 1 bill.
Lesch. Okay. I think we're set to go with Omnibus 1. What's the motion we have to make for this? Just to recommend it.
Recommend it to the two committees.
Okay. So would someone like to move the Omnibus Bill 1? All right. Senator Saxhog moves that what we are calling Omnibus Retirement Bill 1, which is the delete all amendment to Senate File 489 and House File, I don't have that in front of me,
629,
thank you, be recommended to the Senate State and Local Government Committee and the House Government Operations Committee for passage. All right?
As amended.
Anyone else want to testify? All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. All right.
Would indulge me, there is one item that is a housekeeping item, but as of some time urgency or some time consideration, this is a motion, not an amendment to anything. A provision in Minnesota Statutes Chapter 356 requires that the commission approve any changes in the demographic actuarial assumptions used by the various pension funds. And as currently constituted, this applies to local police and paid fire also, or local fire now, volunteer fire. We have a handful of fire relief associations that do provide monthly benefits, utilize mortality assumptions as a consequence. And in two cases, the Hutchinson Fire Department Relief Association and the New Ulm Fire Department, our relief association, want to shift their mortality tables. They want to go from the very old 1971 group annuity mortality tables to the RP 2000 generational mortality tables. The and that is what the motion would do. It would approve those two requests, the letters from the actuary making these requests and showing you what the actuarial impact of the change in both cases are attached.
Representative Murphy. Trust the staff.
Members, the reason why this is being requested now is these valuations are done as of the calendar year and are due to be filed in late spring, early summer.
Representative Driscoll is nodding. Do you want to move the motion?
Well, I was just concurring with what Mr. Martin was saying, that the timeline on that is, this is a mission critical. I did have a question regarding that, though, Ms.
Okay, go ahead,
Chair.
With your question.
Mr. Martin, are you familiar with how many other pensions in the state would have a monthly benefit, and would it behoove us to get in contact with them? Because the mortality table that you're referring to has a longer life expectancy than the 71, and that could affect the dollar amount that's paid out on benefits, just, again, looking at that. My hunch is that the monthly benefit is probably costing more to process the paperwork to put it on a check than it is the value of the check at this point.
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are seven relief associations that pay monthly benefits only, and there are, I believe, 22 that are combination plans where they have an alternative, either a monthly benefit or a lump sum. Several of those are actually phasing out their monthly benefits, and they've closed that off as an option years ago. So there are more than just the two that are here. These are the only two requests we've received in an awful long time from a local relief association plan. The RP 2000 table is more likely to reflect current developments in mortality than the old 1971 group annuity table. Having said that, and not being an actuary, but these plans are so very, very small. They're such a nominal risk pool that having a mortality assumption, as distinct from having a particular mortality assumption, is probably the important thing, that you assume some mortality. It doesn't affect benefits. These folks don't pay optional annuities. There's no benefit amount that's driven by the mortality table. It's simply the funding of the pension plan. These are funded over a relatively short period of time, and as long as we've got some mortality assumption, it's probably close enough. They do actuarial work every 4 years. At least they're required by statute every 4 years, required by general accounting principles to do it every year. The particular table, I can understand why the actuary wants to do the highest standard of their profession. I'm not so sure that it's really a good idea to necessarily prod a sleeping dog at this point and get a whole lot of folks wound up when there might be two retirees receiving a monthly benefit that are 85 years old.
Madam Chair.
Representative Driscoll.
Two things. I concur with Mr. Martin. I just ask it from a policy standpoint, since we've addressed that, and certainly the Commission's known that that's a behavior and a pattern of mine. And second, I will go ahead and move the amendment.
All right. Representative Driscoll moves the M1
motion.
All those in, anyone want to testify? Comments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, well, we'll see you all back on Tuesday, April 2nd, for what will be hopefully our final Pension Commission meeting. Meeting is adjourned.
Representative Saxock's having a party.
Doesn't matter.
Yes, it is.
That Tuesday will get filled up.
Oh, yes, quickly will get filled in. Well, I'm on my way back over to